On today's episode of the Mentoring Minute podcast, we feature a special cross-promotion of Mark Kabaja's June 3rd, 2019 public lecture at the Art Gallery of Alberta called Evaluating Complex Community-Based Initiatives, Emerging Practices. It's recorded by our friends at the Evaluation Capacity Network. If you don't know Mark, you want to know Mark. He's worked across Canada with the Tamarack Institute and many others as a leading voice in evaluation and knowledge mobilization. He's an expert in complex systems and understanding our challenges, and much of what he talks about is very, very applicable to the Canadian mentoring movement. More and more, we are talking about how our mentoring work is part of the complexity that isn't all orbiting around us in the world and the world of our youth. Our outcomes can be so affected by many other competing factors going on in a young person's life. Mark helps us to unpack that complexity, and I think for many of you who are looking at this time of year to take a moment to evaluate and reflect on how your program went and how you wish to improve, this is a very important lecture to think about and let soak in during these summer months. So if you're thinking about your own theory of change, if you're thinking about your own program evaluation, your own strategic plan, we encourage you to listen to Mark, get involved with the Evaluation Capacity Network, and take a look at their resources. We've also linked to Mark's presentation materials, including his excellent and very well done PowerPoint, his resource sheet, and his audio. So please download and share this episode and use those tools. Mark talks about a number of things, including three challenges around evaluation of complexity. He talks about how people want to see impact ASAP and ignore the work required to create the conditions to get there. He talked about how stakeholders often have unreasonable expectations about the pace, the scale, and the durability of change. He talked about how innovators often struggle to fully describe or conceptualize their approach and how it will lead to the hoped-for outcomes in their own theory of change. Does any of this sound familiar? I think it certainly does. I encourage you to join the Evaluation Capacity Network at evaluationcapacitynetwork.com, and thanks again to them for allowing us to cross-promote this episode.
So before I introduce you to the main attraction, why you've come tonight, Mark Kabaja, I just wanted to provide a bit of context to why we're hosting this public lecture. So for those of you who are not familiar with the Evaluation Capacity Network, we're fondly known as ECN. There's our logo over there. There is some purple in the logo. We're an interdisciplinary and intersectoral collaborative that's led out of the Faculty of Extension at the University of Alberta. And our main goal as a network is to bridge community-university evaluation gaps and serve as a central place and space where students, researchers, government, and community organizations can share and access evaluation, expertise, resources, educational opportunities, and networks. So we promote critical learning and reflection about evaluation, and we support partners in generating and collecting valuable information about the relevance and effectiveness of their programs, policies, and practices. So today, we kicked off one of our formal evaluation learning and capacity building initiatives, the UEVAL. And the UEVAL is a one-week intensive evaluation course. Some of our students have joined us here tonight, that's being piloted this week. So we have 52 learners, and those are across several undergraduate departments, graduate programs across the University of Alberta, and even other faculties, other universities, and also community-based organizations. So this public lecture was created to kick off the Institute and further engage students, academics, government, and community in evaluation learning. So we hope you enjoy your time with us this evening. And I now want to introduce the main attraction, Mark. And when we wrap up today, we are going to have some food and beverages upstairs. So we hope you can join us for a short reception and networking event. And Mark will stick around too if you have additional questions for him. Okay. So Mark Kabaja is the president of the consulting company Here to There, as well as a fellow of the Tamarack Institute. Just last month, he became a fellow of the J.W. McConnell Foundation. His work currently focuses on how diverse organizations and communities work together to tackle complex issues, the title of our conversation tonight, on social innovation as a sub-scene of community change work, and on strategic learning and evaluation. Mark has firsthand knowledge of using evaluation as a policymaker, philanthropist, and activist, and he's been working with organizations developing innovative responses to complex issues for 30 years in Europe and Canada. So join me in welcoming Mark Kabaj.
Thanks, Rebecca. Hi, everyone. How's the sound? Good? Hey, thanks for coming. It's Monday, spring / summer in Edmonton. There's a blue sky, not an orange sky. We thought the thing would be empty tonight, but you guys came. As we've chatted about before, sometimes evaluation evokes the same response from people as colonoscopy or root canal, so to get 100 and some people in an audience listening to this is pretty terrific. So thank you, Rebecca, to you and the team for inviting me. Part of the reason I'm pleased to be here is because Rebecca and the team asked me to be here. I'm a big fan of CUP, and not only think the team is really good, but is super professional and does so many great things for the community in terms of applied work, that Edmonton is a better place because CUP is here. So it's great to be here for that. Again, thanks to you. You didn't have to come here, and I'm going to ask you shortly why you did to talk about this. And I'm pleased that you're starting this course, CUP, with this EU philosophy, this idea, which is simply your latest commitment to improving evaluation capacity, not just in Edmonton, but in Canada. I've never been in this location, and this is one of my favorite buildings in Edmonton. Whenever I tell people that Edmonton is cool, I always start off by showing them this building, and then they begin to believe me. And finally, this topic, I've been preoccupied with this topic for about 1996?
Close.
A long time. When I was overseas doing international development work, I've told this vignette a couple of times, I was frustrated with getting evaluation feedback. I was administering grants to international development programs, and I always felt like it wasn't really answering my questions or coming in at a time that was useful for me. And so it was really lodged into my mind as I came back home to Canada in 94, 95 to get a graduate degree. And in fact, as I did my graduate degree in Waterloo, I did it on the overall effectiveness and cost benefit of community economic development organizations, and did a heck of a lot of work on it. And then did so much work that I got asked to be the editor of a magazine called Making Waves, which was around community economic development. And I want to show you a picture of a cartoon that I had the editor make for me. He was a cartoonist as well, that says, "Don, this has to capture the essence of the magazine's theme, and it should reflect what I'm going to look like in 20 some years." It's unfortunately accurate. I'm not kidding. This is 20 some years ago. He was awfully accurate. So here's what I learned in those early days. This is what I would have wished if I was in an EVALU course, that I obsessed about metrics and methods. Like, I love them. I did cost-benefit analysis, any kind of quantitative method. I did got into qualitative method. I became a mixed method disciple, and realized that that wasn't actually helping me as much as really backing up, slowing down, zooming out, and getting an understanding on the perspectives of how and when evaluation is useful and how to make it useful and key principles to make that happen. And so I'm still a methods person and a metric person and a qualitative person. I advocate that we get really, really good at that, but that's not the game of evaluation. Evaluation is about reality testing, looking at what we are trying to do on complex issues and getting feedback about whether our hunches are right, learning, making judgments, and continuing this relentless incrementalism that is required to make steady progress on community change. So as we get into this, I'm going to ask you quickly to re-engage with yourself just for about 2 or 3 minutes and turn to the person next to you, knowing we're going to talk for the next 40 minutes about this topic, complex change initiatives and the emerging evaluation practices. Why are you here and not somewhere else? You could have gone somewhere else. You thought this was the highest and best use of your time to come here. So just spend 2 or 3 minutes, twos or threes, however you like. Remind yourself why you're here and not somewhere else. Okay, have a quick go. All right, everyone, thank you for that. We're going to chat a couple more times in small groups, but it's good to remind yourself why you're here. I am here because I, a while ago, well, again, in the 1950s, had this moment in time where I had a paradigm shift, to use a word that's used too often, where I stopped looking at the world through the lens of simplicity, as if it was completely knowable. And started looking at it through a complexity lens, which gave me a simply a different version of how the world unfolds. And it was that kind of paradigm shift that actually helped me put the cart in front of the horse rather than behind the horse, a complexity-aware perspective of the world that we could spend a lot of time on. In fact, let's just do a quick show of hands. Who spent a little bit of time trying to understand what looking through the world through a complexity lens looks like? Okay, about half the group, a little bit more than half. We're not going to spend a ton of time on this evening because some of you already know it, but I'm going to give you a very quick shorthand, a reminder for some of us. And for those that are interested, maybe we can do something in the Q&A and I can share more resources for you if you'd like to go a bit deeper on this. But I'm going to do this just with a couple of quotes to refresh our mind, refresh our understanding of this, and then we'll talk about the evaluation implications. So, Rebecca, I'm going to ask you for help on the first one. I've used this quote, and I'm going to use a video that you've seen before, some of you as well, just because I find they're so good. This is a quote of someone dealing with a complex challenge or a problematic complex situation, and I think it captures in miniature what many of us struggle with or many complex issues exhibit in terms of the number of interrelated dynamic moving parts. Rebecca,
Okay.
Every problem magnifies the impact of the others, and all are so tightly interlocked that one reversal can produce a chain reaction with results far distant from the original causes. A rundown apartment can exacerbate a child's asthma, which leads to a call from an ambulance, which generates a medical bill that cannot be paid, which ruins a credit record, which hikes the interest rate on an auto loan, which forces the purchase of an unreliable used car, which jeopardizes a mother's punctuality at work, which limits her promotions and earning capacity, which confines her to poor housing. If problems are interlocking, then so too solutions must be. A job alone is not enough. Medical insurance alone is not enough. Good housing alone is not enough. Reliable transportation, careful family budgeting, effective parenting, effective schooling are not enough when each is achieved in isolation from the rest.
Thanks, Rebecca. So that's powerful. I mean, I don't know about you. I think this is an unbelievably powerful quote. It's by a fellow named David Schiffler called Invisible in America, The Experience of Being Working Poor. And I really like this because it reminds us of something else. This is her problematic situation is symptomatic of a systemic situation. Karen Pittman, the CEO of Youth Investment 3 years ago at a Tamarack Institute event, said programmatic interventions help people beat the odds, systemic interventions change their odds. If we're in the game of moving needles on complex issues, we're in the game of systems change and moving complex systems. So systems make people vulnerable or well. And if you addressing someone's vulnerability is to think and act systemically. So I'm gonna show you this video now. Again, this is probably the last time I'm gonna show this in a couple years, but I thought I'd pull it out one more time for this. I'll ask for a bit of help upstairs there to start this video. It's 4 minutes long. Here's a metaphor for a complex adaptive system and an illustration of how dynamic they are. Three and a half minutes long.
One of the most exciting scientific findings of the past half century has been the discovery of widespread trophic cascades. A trophic cascade is an ecological process which starts at the top of the food chain and tumbles all the way down to the bottom. And the classic example is what happened in the Yellowstone National Park in the United States when wolves were reintroduced in 1995. Now, we all know that wolves kill various species of animals, but perhaps we're slightly less aware that they give life to many others. Before the wolves turned up, they'd been absent for 70 years, but the numbers of deer, because there was nothing to hunt them, had built up in the Yellowstone Park, and despite efforts by humans to control them, they'd managed to reduce much of the vegetation there to almost nothing. They just grazed it away. But as soon as the wolves arrived, even though there were few in number, they started to have the most remarkable effects. First, of course, they killed some of the deer, but that wasn't the major thing. Much more significantly, they radically changed the behavior of the deer. The deer started avoiding certain parts of the park, the places where they could be trapped most easily, particularly the valleys and the gorges. And immediately, those places started to regenerate. In some areas, the height of the trees quintupled in just 6 years. Bare valley sides quickly became forests of aspen and willow and cottonwood. And as soon as that happened, the birds started moving in. The number of songbirds and migratory birds started to increase greatly. The number of beavers started to increase because beavers like to eat the trees. And beavers, like wolves, are ecosystem engineers. They create niches for other species. And the dams they built in the rivers provided habitats for otters and muskrats and ducks and fish and reptiles and amphibians. The wolves killed coyotes, and as a result of that, the number of rabbits and mice began to rise, which meant more hawks, more weasels, more foxes, more badgers. Ravens and bald eagles came down to feed on the carrion that the wolves had left. Bears fed it too, and their population began to rise as well, partly also because there were more berries growing on the regenerating shrubs. And the bears reinforced the impact of the wolves by killing some of the calves of the deer. But here's where it gets really interesting. The wolves changed the behavior of the rivers. They began to meander less. There was less erosion, the channels narrowed, more pools formed, more riffle sections, all of which were great for wildlife habitats. The rivers changed in response to the wolves. And the reason was that the regenerating forests stabilized the banks so that they collapsed less often, so that the rivers became more fixed in their course. Similarly, by driving the deer out of some places and the vegetation recovering on the valley sides, there was a soil erosion because the vegetation stabilized that as well. So the wolves, small in number, transformed not just the ecosystem of the Yellowstone National Park, this huge area of land, but also its physical geography.
So who's seen that video before? Okay, not. For those of you who've seen it, you'll see it one more time. For those of you who haven't, wolves change rivers. And I like it because it reminds us, even though it's a biological or an ecosystem story, about the nature of systems in general. And some of these features represent communities as well. So when we think about complex adaptive systems, which a community is, there's lots of multiple actors who may have different perspectives on what's going on and different interests of what's going on. The actors in a system drive the behavior of the system. They have permeable boundaries, so that was talking about Yellowstone National Park. We could be talking about Strathcona White Avenue, but that is nested in other systems that affect how that system operates. Cross-scale dynamics, small things make an impact at higher systems, and big things like provincial policies will have their effects felt at the scale of White Avenue. They have emergent behaviors. This is really interesting. The behavior of the system is actually the result of everyone interacting with each other. So food system in Edmonton, how many actors do you think there are in the food system in Greater Edmonton?
A lot.
At least 1.5 million, because there's at least 1.5 million people eating food. Those are actors, right? Who else? People who do health, looking at whether the restaurants are being providing hygienic spaces, transportation, producers, etc. Those are all actors, and food prices and eating habits are the cumulative effect of all those things going on, right? That's the entire behavior of the system. You have to zoom out to understand that. A couple other things. Systems have nonlinear effects. Think about this for community and change. You intervene into a complex system, and your intervention and the outcome do not have a linear relationship. Big is then when it pushed in hard and tried to intervene hard into a community system and no changes happened. Oops. Yes, we do it all the time. Have you ever seen a situation where a little intervention creates a tipping point and things change dramatically. That's called nonlinear behavior. There's no relationship between the two. Why there's too many variables is too difficult to predict. And they create splatters of outcome. No one understood what the ripple effects of that wolf story were going to be. Right? We really didn't know. That's called a trophic cascade. It comes from the top. Same thing happens from the bottom. I've actually forgotten the name of it. When you start from the bottom, splatter of effects. Fine. If systems change forever and ever and ever, they're always moving. You never intervene into the same system twice. And finally, systems have defense immune responses. They like to operate. Has anyone ever worked in an institution that's quite cautious? Right? It resists. It has its own sense of inertia. And we could get very philosophical about this. There's actually value in being cautious in a system, but there's moments where it's incredibly irritating and a heck of a lot of work. So that lady, that woman's experience of that was experiencing the downward spiral, and we really would like that to be an upward spiral, she's embedded in a complex set of adaptive systems in a community that exhibit these behaviors as well. So that's part two of things being complex. Number three, complex issues require complex interventions that often may start with simple interventions, but over time start to get a lot of moving parts if you're paying attention. Here, anyone from Winnipeg here? Winnipeg's North End is a great little case study. The North End Renewal Corporation, when they started doing their work, they actually had an idea about dealing with housing and safety and economic development. So the first thing they did is they agreed to a strategy called Link and Leverage. They created a renewal corporation, and the strategy of Link and Leverage was whenever we intervene into something, we're going to link it to something else and start creating a platform that creates something called the development system that can handle comprehensive integrated issues. So that's a philosophy, it's a theory, it's a sort of a principle. So the first thing they do is they actually want to do housing renewal, because everyone's talking about housing renewal in the first end. But they say, how can we do housing renewal in a way that builds up hope and social capital in our community? People have to start believing this community can change. So can we do housing renewal in a way that does that? They said they could. They said, let's not sprinkle it across the community. Let's concentrate it on a block-by-block basis so people see entire blocks being regained. They did that, and sure enough, the social capital was so strong that people started forming walking clubs, community gardens, and community safety committees. Right? So boom, they started this block-by-block thing. This is starting to take off. So what do they do then? They say, listen, how come we're buying all the supplies from outside the neighborhood when our core downtown area, we could be buying supplies from there? So what do? They start buying millions of dollars of renewal supplies, lumber, nails. Here's Mark talking about construction. Construction type things. And they start buying local supplies. They get real kudos from the local suppliers. In fact, one says, why don't you guys think about employees? So they say, you agree, let's talk to the businesses who are doing this. Could you hire local youth? They say no. So they create a social enterprise. They create a social enterprise that hires youth, half of whom happen to have been involved in groups that were wrecking some of the houses in the first place. Then they find out that the government, the federal government, has got this environmental grant for retrofitting houses and doing solar, etc. Who's best positioned to do that? Right? So they take on a solar and a green agenda. They have built, by linking and leveraging, a development system. The reason interventions into complex issues that tackle one issue one at a time fail to succeed is because they tackle one issue at a time. These things are interrelated. We don't need more specialization, we need orchestration. So, hold on to this, folks. Complex issues embedded in complex adaptive systems will eventually see complex interventions emerge, dynamic, evolving, participatory over time, if we're paying attention. So this is interesting, because it creates challenges for traditional stance on evaluation. Now, here's a little bit of a, I just found this prepping for it this weekend. Here's the distinction between a more expert-driven approach to dealing with poverty and one that I would call is more complexity-aware. Can you see the distinction between the two worldviews, what it reveals to people in terms of how to think about things? That young mother that we saw in the beginning, she can't see the separation between all those different elements, right? But if someone sitting at a desk could, who's not involved in the work. So we could have a whole discussion about how do we plan and intervene better with a complexity-aware perspective. Don't worry, that's tough enough. I mean, that's tough, but we're going to have enough problems with evaluation. So here's the evaluation challenge. Evaluation grew up in the projects in the 1950s and 60s when positivist worldviews and sort of a social engineering worldview were really dominant. And there's, I'm going to simplify it, talking about it as sort of social engineering worldview. Figure it out, go intervene, get some feedback, and then adapt. That has a partial truth to it, except if we're going to pay attention to the complexity of things, we may not think more like social engineers. We might want to think more like ecosystem participants who understand the interrelatedness of things and watch how systems unfold and be very thoughtful about how people intervene into complex systems and, more importantly, getting ready for the endless act, react, adapt. Act, react, and adapt. That is the hallmark of intervening into complex community issues at a local level. Adaptive responses to complex issues. Now, we did that fairly quick, folks, so if some of you want to talk a little bit more about complexity-aware responses, there is a renaissance going on. There's so much going on. And it's, anyone watch The Matrix? Remember that moment? Tell me if I got this wrong. Oh boy, I should not start metaphors that I don't know how to finish. But they take the pill, right? There's this world that everything looks a certain way and it's clear and it's accessible and makes sense. And then you take this pill, which actually shows you that things are kind of gray and not always as nice as you think, but that's the reality pill. And you have a choice to take that pill again or go back to the other way. I took the pill of complexity and I can't see the world any other way. I find it liberating. Sometimes, though, I'd like to take the other pill and go back to the old worldview because this is pretty darn taxing. So let's play a little bit further with this. In October, Rebecca, we were already dealing with this, weren't we? We talked a little bit about evaluation from the perspective of the title Good, Bad, and the Ugly. And so what we talked about were six key evaluation issues, but how our stance as an evaluator might affect how we dealt with those things. And we actually said bad would be if we were a traditional evaluator that was driven by expert opinion, quantitative methods, randomized controlled trials, etc. And I'm overstating this for the purpose of effect, right? That would give us, we wouldn't see the complexity of this story, the wolves changing rivers, if we were overly traditional, and certainly not as participatory as we needed to be. If we were sheer accountability driven, which is sort of the flavor of the last 15 years for many people giving out grants, we would be asking people, did you see what you were going to do? Did you do what you were going to do? Did you generate your outcomes on a fixed schedule? We'd miss most of the story. If we were complexity aware developmental, that would be good. We would at least have the chance to see what was unfolding, what was a learning, and maybe have the possibility to adapt in real time. So we did that 2 years ago in a beautiful building not far from here. Here's what we're going to do today. We're going to talk only quickly about three different issues around community change, and there are way, way more than this. It took me a lot of effort to come down to these three. There's lots of work around what are different forms of knowledge and data from gender perspectives, from ethnocultural perspectives. How do we get 360-degree intelligence on what's going on? There's lots of questions about how the age-old debate between quantitative and qualitative methods. I just think it's a silly debate. The solution is no narratives without numbers and no numbers without narratives. We have to be mixed, use mixed methods in this world. There's endlessly more debates, but I wanted to focus on these three, because these three actually are not just for evaluators, but they're for innovators and funders as well. And if the stakes of getting at complex issues are operating in complex adaptive systems, we all have to be literate on these things. And as I present them, these are my opinions and I have every right to change them. So, and you can change my mind too. My mind is easily changed. My favorite philosopher is Bertrand Russell, who says I'm not willing to die for my beliefs because I might be wrong. But I feel these are directionally correct, even though there's clumsiness involved in them. Okay, so let's hold on. We're gonna do three in a row. As we do this, she's not purple, but her name is Brenda Zimmerman, and I was highly instructed by her 15 years ago when I asked her, Brenda, when you talk about complex things, how do you talk about them to people? Because people get lost in the complexity, and then what they really want is recipes and cookie-cutter solutions, and she says, never do that. Never give them a false simplicity, because they'll just get to the wrong place faster. She said, here's the challenge. Frame the challenges so that they are coherent. You sensitize and normalize challenges. provide principles that guide people's thinking and action, and then give them illustrative examples and practices and techniques, aids for action, that they might use in their own practice. So I'm going to channel Brenda Zimmerman here, and I'm going to talk about these three challenges and then describe them as principles and practices. Here's the first one, big thing in community change efforts. People often want to see impact ASAP. Do you agree? Mm-hmm. They want to see impact now. We've got this reductionist culture, get her done, show me what you've done, etc., etc. And we understand why it is, because not only is money important, but every life is precious, and there's a lot of people struggling pretty big, right? And so this is not a trivial thing. People want to see impact. But we ignore what it takes to actually create the conditions for impact, and this doesn't happen overnight. I'm going to give you a real quick example of this from a place called Calgary. I've been there, it's an actual city. And they've done some terrific work around payday lending, and payday lending sucks if you're in vulnerable situations, because the volume of money required to use payday lending services is simply excessive, right? It can be 600% a year when you aggregate how much the penalties are. So that's a lot of money. So what they did is they started organizing at a community level to deal with this. Now I'm going to show you this diagram, and it's not terrific, but let me describe what it is after it's been purpleized. The bottom, this says impact is on the right-hand scale. In order to get there, there's three levels of outcomes at different scales. Number one, bottom one, supporting and amplifying niche innovations. Complex issues require innovative responses sometimes. These are programmatic projects, small-scale innovations that, if they prove useful, could be expanded. And most communities deal with niche innovations. The next one is nudging systems and policy. This is actually regulations, resource flows, authority, decision-making power, etc. These are the systems that reproduce problems and even keep them in place. Can we nudge systems to operate differently? And the top one, whoa, you really can't see, is shifting awareness or narratives. Narratives, identity, beliefs around, do you even know what the issue is? Do you believe we can do something about it? Can we shift your narrative and identity where you find it within your self-interest or your ethical worldview to begin to do something about this? This is really important because most systems are held in place, embedded in deep cultural, political, value-based narratives and worldviews. So what this argues is, if you're going to see impact over time, we are going to be working across scale. This is, by the way, called the transition framework by Frank Gehl's multiple level perspective. Here's what they did in Calgary. First of all, an NGO secured a policy director. They were doing programmatic interventions, and they said programmatic interventions are not dealing well enough with this. We can tell people about budgets and payday lending. Structurally, they're still hooped. This is why they go to payday lending. So they did that, and then they actually did some research called the cost of payday lending. That, in turn, prompted them to begin organizing on International Ave, where there was 11 payday lenders in concentration, and the local residents were upset about this and started to organize. They lent their way to the initiative. They then actually go to the Calgary Herald, and they work with the editorial board to get this consistently talked about in the Calgary Herald. Calgary Herald is the biggest paper, like the journal in Edmonton. So they start influencing a bellwether. They then agreed to get the End Poverty Calgary version of End Poverty Edmonton to put payday lending in the official End Poverty Plan of Calgary. So this is one of their key issues. They create a financial empowerment collaborative. They start piloting cash crunch loans with financial institutions because they know they have to create an alternative to payday lending. You can't just shut down payday lending. People are going to go somewhere. So they start dealing with cash crunch loans. What do they learn? They learn, why do people not go to traditional financial institutions and instead go to payday lending? Anyone know? It takes too long to get a loan. You feel judged if you go in asking for some of the stuff you're to do. There's all these, they start educating you, etc. And people go, it's just a pain in the butt. It's actually disempowering. I'm not going there. So the payday lending is not an aberration. It is completely natural. People go there for a reason. So this is what we were learning in the pilot project. They were learning rich. Then they start getting philanthropic leaders engaged, really engaged. And in Calgary, the organizing style of Calgary is you get patricians involved, wealthy people who can move systems. That's a Calgary organizing cultural thing. Then they get the cities to change bylaws, two of them, a licensing bylaw and a land use bylaw. These two bylaws together, this is a long game, will make it increasingly difficult for payday lenders to concentrate. Small win, but the big win comes after they start relentlessly working with new folks, and they inform the provincial government's Act on Predatory Lending, which starts mainstreaming, helps mainstreaming cash crunch loans. Why? Because here's the impact. Payday lenders in the province dropped from 230 to 165 in 2 years. Borrowers' rates dropped from $23 per loan to $15 per loan, and the total volume of lending went down from $500 million to $285 million in 2 years. Alberta now has the lowest payday lending rates in Canada. Individual borrowers, pilots, and new payday loans reduced borrowing costs by an estimate of a third. And remember, unanticipated outcomes? Mount Royal Research is chasing this. There might be an increase on online borrowing, and we know that payday lenders are now pushing larger scale installment loans. You intervene into a complex system, it intervenes back at you. Mm-hmm. It's endless act, react, adapt. But would you agree that we got some outcomes here? We did, but look at all the intermediate work it required to get those outcomes. And that took about 8 years. Now, so what's the principle? We have to figure out how to widen and lengthen our gaze on what outcomes are. This immediate bottom line thinking won't lead to anything. You can't get those impacts without doing the heavy lifting that a group like the Financial Collaborative did. That's just a metaphor for all our efforts. Impact requires all these intermediate outcomes. There's lots of things we could do, but one of them includes using things like multi-level perspective to give people a line of sight about if we achieve this, eventually we'll achieve that, and be very, very patient, be relentlessly incremental, because it's not going to happen overnight. This is a paradigm change we need at the evaluators level and at the investors level, the innovators level, and the policymakers. Here's a real complex problem. Anyone know where this picture from the left comes from? This is up north right now. We have people, I only have 11 minutes.
Or less.
Okay, I'm not gonna tell this story. I will say that the Energy Futures Lab has focused on the debate in Alberta where it's a narrative level problem. They're saying in order for energy transition to happen and to deal with climate change, we have to tackle a polarity that's really detrimental, and it's this polarity of drill baby drill or keep it in the ground. None of those things is going to help things move, right? And the more we reinforce that polarity, the more we're not going to move on stuff, and we're going to start seeing crazy swings like we're seeing now, right? So what they're saying is the middle in Alberta now is radical. We need a radical middle in Alberta for people who accept climate change and that the energy transition is required, and it's not going to happen overnight. And that's not all that easy. So Chad Parks, and I won't run the video here, he talks about this overcoming the energy polarity. And they created an Energy Futures Lab who have the following three features: a forum for ongoing experimentation, innovation, and collaboration with 75 fellows from the oil and gas industry, alternative energy industry, First Nations organizations, NGOs like Pembina and others, the government of Alberta, and local, rural, and urban communities. Their job is to exemplify the radical middle. And they do that in a bunch of different ways. Not only a face for experimentation, but to deal with new conversations and to reframe the public narrative. So here's what happened not long ago in the very first session. A proud environmental warrior was in a, ever do a fishbowl where people come talk in the middle? Mm-hmm. We were talking about the discussion, is oil a dirty word? And we had these diverse players come in. She sat down and she made a very convincing case about the need for transition, and then someone else said something about oil and gas companies pillaging the earth. It was bound to come out something like that. So the other person that was in there, he is very proud of the gas industry and what has been contributed and his environmental record. So he stood up and that person was leaving the football and he was red. And he said, get back in here. You can't say something like that and just leave. Because if we can't deal with these conversations, who will? And if we don't do it now, when? I get goosebumps just telling you that. It was powerful. And then they came in and they fought like crazy. These different worldviews. And that night, knowing that the stakes were high, that they were meant to be exemplars, they went bull riding. Mechanical bull riding. I'm not kidding. It's not the natural thing to do, but they went and did it. And they became friends. And they're exemplars for the project because there's 75 people here. And I did a network analysis, and you should see all the intermingling now. They are now doing a joint venture together, a big multi-million dollar joint venture, and they disagree on a lot of things, but they don't disagree on the need to at least have a radical middle position. Now, there's lots of different stories here, including when we did a bellwether evaluation, one of our bellwethers to figure out whether we were shifting the public narrative was to track the business editor of the Calgary Herald. Does anyone know who that is? Debra Yedlin? Tova teaches at the U of A, or used to. She's pretty mainstream in her arguments. She doesn't even know we exist. We've been tracking her for 3 or 4 years. We can't get her to acknowledge us. She doesn't talk about any of her messages. She has a huge constituency. We are not shifting that narrative at all. But we are contributing to the shift in narrative of J.W. Nichols, which is an industry magazine which is slightly progressive, out of center, and they've called this energy transition framing the bright light in energy transition in North America. And they have a huge constituency. So we're tracking changes at intermediate levels. Why? Because we know we don't have population level impacts, because we have all this contextual stuff that's way bigger than us. But we are seeing, and we're tracking it now, geographic implications, GHG reductions in certain communities and economic resiliency, and we've got tons of programmatic outcomes. There are tons of it. So is this a failure? I'll tell you. You know how much this entire lab costs after 4 years? The price of one of those heavy trucks in Fort McMurray. The price of one. Takes some time. It takes time. Okay, here we go. Stakeholders, number two, unreasonable expectations about the pace, scale, and durability of change. So number one is, what does it take to eventually get there? People have crazy expectations about what we can actually achieve, even when we're at our very best. So here's a great case study. Who's ever followed the Head Start program stuff? Okay, this comes from conversations we've had with you. What's the big beef with Head Start by those who are grumpy? Or at least grumpy about Head Start. It's the fade-out effect. We know from randomized controlled trials, lots of studies, that Head Start actually accelerates and amplifies people's learning scores, learning abilities, and basic skills to quite a level, and right up and gets them ready for school up until grade 1 and 2. And then the effects, is it grade 1 and 2, grade 2, Gloria?
Between 2 and 3,
and then they begin to fade, right? So is that failure? People go, what's the point? It stops in grade 2. That's a common thing. How come it doesn't ballistically catapult them into Harvard? Well, maybe we have a distinction in our language when something doesn't work out. Maybe it's implementation failure or strategy or theory failure, right? Oh, the theory and the strategy is good, but we didn't implement well. Or we implemented well, but the strategy and theory didn't work out. What if it's expectation failure? What if we are so crazy out of whack about what is reasonable to expect? This is an evaluator's job to point that out. So this is big because the Aspen Institute from 1990 to the year 2010 evaluated 41 community initiatives in comprehensive community initiatives that had lasted a minimum of 10 years, some of them 20 in the United States, $1 billion in philanthropic investment, leveraging $10 billion in public. One community initiative had an evaluation budget of, actually they had 10 communities, this was the Annie E. Casey Foundation. Guess what their evaluation budget was? 10 communities, 10 years, $60 million. Whoa. And they found we get programmatic outcomes, we get systemic outcomes, we have capacity building outcomes, but very rarely do we see deep and durable population level outcomes. Is that implementation failure, theory failure? Maybe it's expectation failure. Maybe the kinds of things we're seeing are pretty good investments with pretty good outcomes, but if we're to take them seriously, we have to rearrange what we think is appropriate. Let me give you a very quick example of this. Dudley Street neighborhood in Boston. Has anyone heard of Dudley Street? Yeah? One of the benchmark neighborhood change initiatives in North America. Plenty of problems with Dudley Street, but clearly one of the benchmark leaders. 1985, they're presented with a community plan from philanthropists from outside the community. There's 200 people at the meeting, and they say, buzz off. We're not doing it. That's not our plan. That's your plan. That evening, the philanthropist turned it around and said, we will create a plan and an institution that you can drive. And they created a 31-member board, where 16 of the members were residents, 4 from Cape Verde communities, 4 from Latino, 4 from African American, and 4 from the white community. And they created this institution that over time, for 5 or 6 years, worked on granular neighborhood-specific things. clean up the garbage. People were dumping garbage there. Create safe streets, playgrounds, normal quality of life issues. Then they received something called eminent domain. The city owned 50% of 380 lots that were not being used. The city gave this to the neighborhood. 180 lots, 250 acres worth of stuff. It's the only neighborhood in North America that has eminent domain in their neighborhood. They created a housing process where you could get housing if you were low income, and you were guaranteed housing at favorable rates. They start building community centers, urban village shopping centers, etc. And 20 some years later, crime rate goes from 61% down to 21%, which outpaces the Boston average by a factor of four. They've got 320 new housing units. They've got 425 businesses, went up to 650 businesses. They have 3,700 voting members on the community now. And way in 1975, they did an assessment. One out of five people wanted to stay. Four out of five wanted to leave. Now the number is reversed. Four out of five want to stay. One out of five want to leave. And 50% of the community agrees that it gets better and better every single year. Here's the kicker. At the very end of this process in 2008, when the book was being written, 2009, the financial crisis was creating ripple effects across the United States, people losing their home. No one in Dudley Street lost their home. Okay, what does that mean? Almost there, Rebecca. Employ practices that encourage stakeholders to take a reality check about what is possible in their interventions. What are the practices to do that? Here are some of mine. You might have better ones. This is my best guess. Do ex-ante evaluation, which is evaluation even before it begins. They do this a lot in international development. Do a pre-mortem, saying this thing isn't going to work. How come? Has anyone done a pre-mortem? Yeah, has anyone done a post-mortem? I hope. A pre-mortem is you sit there and you go, okay, we're about to launch this thing. Let's pretend it's 10 years later and it flopped. Right? It just flopped. What are all the reasons it flopped? And what you do there is you give people permission to say stuff that they're now scared to say because they're so close to implementation. Right? And they start generating stuff, and it might be expectation issues, strategy issues, implementation issues. Review evaluations of similar efforts, like we just did with Dudley, benchmark. And include expectation failure as part of the questioning when people results are not forthcoming. And ask people, you are disappointed, we are disappointed possibly, that we thought there'd be more results. Is this an implementation issue, a strategy issue, or an expectation issue? Normalize that. Okay, last one. Here's the big thing. Innovators often struggle to conceptualize the intervention, right? Innovators want to make change, and evaluators go, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what your it is. I don't know what your indicators are, what an outcome is, and how to get there. Surrey, British Columbia is a great example of this. Surrey, British Columbia, I'll share this quickly one more time. When they started their evaluation, their initiative, they agreed that they wanted to reduce the number of homeless day laborers in that community, but they didn't have a strategy. They only had two principles. Get a worm's eye view of what it was like to be a homeless day laborer and zoom out and have a bird's eye policy, systemic response to make sure it didn't happen to others. So the first thing they found out, we've done this with at least a third of the crowd, so let me rehearse with you. They found out that homeless day laborers can't get into shelters at night because that they're late, they're working. The shelters closed their door, and shelters require proof of welfare receipt as a condition for getting entry, a 50-year-old practice. So the group comes together and they say to the shelters, hey, would you not do that? Could you let them in? And the shelters say, oh yeah, okay. It was a little bit harder than that, but but they did. So they busted a practice, a systemic practice. Next thing they found out is homeless day laborers are making $9 an hour or $8 an hour, and the companies paying them are actually paying the temp agencies double that. So they called a meeting again. They said, would you stop? They talked to the temp agencies. Would you not do that? And they said, no, we have to. They showed us the business books. And the business books demonstrate that not only is it a predatory business, it's a bad business. It's a borderline business. They would go out of business by taking less. So then the agencies work with the nonprofit agencies to fulfill the intermediary function and can convince 75% of the construction companies to move their business. So how much are the homeless day laborers making now? Double. Double within weeks, guys. You don't need a randomized control trial for this. This is double within weeks. What employment program has ever done that? Then they find out that because they did that, homeless day laborers can no longer get automatic deposit, which really frustrates the construction companies because they don't have addresses. So they start, they go to the big banks and they say, could you do some work with us on the addresses? And the big banks say, nope, can't, run out of Toronto, too rigid. They didn't say that, but that was our interpretation. And then they work with the local credit union to create a suite of financial products for the working poor. That story goes on, and some of you have heard me go on and on. That group did not start out with content. It started out with process. It showed what we would call emergent strategy. Here's the challenge. When evaluation started and innovators were not giving us the conceptualizations of the interventions we wanted, we did something called evaluability assessment. We said, we're not going to evaluate your stuff unless you meet all these checkboxes. You've got indicators, you've got a good pathway, etc. And no one did anything. No one even listened to the evaluators. Some people do evaluability assessments, not too many. So then we created logic models. We thought, well, if they're not going to do it, we'll help them do logic models or results chains. Who's ever done one of those? They can be helpful in certain circumstances. They're not very good for complexity stuff. So we started creating theory of change, which was even better. Here's the problem. Most people don't have a theory of change, innovators, or they have varying levels of it. They have a hunch of change. They have some opening moves and some opening ideas. And what they want to do is intervene into the system, learn more, and then act, react, adapt. I like this one, the logic model repair shop. Oh, I thought I was going to get a huge laugh. I'll spend more time on this next time. Okay, so what do we do? Well, how about we conceptualize strategies in a way that helps the innovator sharpen their thinking about what it is they're trying to do, but allows them to use something that suits their circumstances and acknowledges where they are on a continuum of being clear where things are. There's a typo there, my editor told me, desired impact under emergent strategies. But what Suri did was an emergent strategy, and Henry Mintzberg argues that most companies actually start with an emergent strategy. They have some opening moves, and through a relentless process of trial and error, new insights emerge. They get new insights, and they begin to develop a strategy, like in Suri. Ooh, it's about access to services. It's about access to financial products at the bank. It's about patching income, part-time income with your welfare receipt, etc. They start to create a structure. That's umbrella strategy, where you have rough structure around it, but you allow for a hell of a lot of improv in between. All the way to detailed strategy. Does that make sense? And depending on the level of certainty, do you know what the issue is and how to address it? Do you have everyone on the same page? If you do, go ahead for detailed strategy. Float your boat. If you don't, you might start off with emergent strategy, and there is discipline in emergent strategy, as the Surrey case study shows. I can't tell the story because we have time, but has anyone ever read John McKnight's Community and Its Counterfeits? Yeah, very interesting book. There's a case study there of a community health center in Chicago where the process strategy was the Saul Alinsky community organizing strategy. People said, we have medical issues in the community that are overly medicalized, they're community issues. Dog bites, car crashes, bronchial ailments, etc. And they captured the two medical centers in that community, and they started community mobilizing, and they started moving needles on all of these things. Though that was a principle-driven strategy, not a content-driven strategy. We're going to confirm here that we could have talked about a heck of a lot more stuff than this. There's lots of stuff. When you take that pill of complexity awareness and start looking at the world of communities like ecosystems rather than social engineers, it has just tremendously transformational implications. Simple ideas that may have complex implications for, this is just for innovators and people who fund and do policy making. In the evaluation field, listen, we're always catching up. In fact, if you're an evaluator, you should have a hat that says, hi, I'm their evaluator, which way did they go? It's very hard for us to catch up and to be useful for innovators. We are informed by traditional practices, but we have a heck of a lot of self-correction to do by adopting a complexity-aware lens. We have the responsibility for changing that stuff because most people don't understand some of the fundamentals of evaluation, and I argue often they don't need to. They just need to be good change makers. If they were more literate in some of the stuff, that would be great. We have the responsibility of adjusting our own practice. There is a quote from in the Torah, I always use, that says most complex issues are not solved overnight. They are solved by embracing relentless incrementalism. Our field is relentlessly adapting right now. And even though we may get frustrated because we don't see the end of some of these adaptations in our own practice, we have to start. And this is the quote from the Torah. It's not for us to finish the task, but surely it is to begin. Thanks for your time. Do we have time for people to chat or do Q&A, or should we vamos, Rebecca?
Yeah, we have maybe even just a couple minutes.
Why don't we do this? Rather than just open to question, I just said some things that may or may not have stuck for you. Why don't you go back into the group that you started with in terms of why you came here and ask what's alive for you? A thought, a question, a feeling. How are you feeling at the end of this 40-minute sprint talking about the implications for evaluation? And then we'll just see if there's a question or two, but please have a chat so you can say something before you leave. Okay? Back to your small group.
Okay, I'm just going to bring us back to the larger conversation. So we are a little bit over time, and there is food upstairs, so I want to make sure for those keep my own stomach that's grumbling. But does anybody have any burning questions that you want to ask Mark? He'll also be upstairs, too, if you want to catch him one-on-one.
Or observations.
Or observations from his talk, beyond the fact that it was purple.
Something.
Yeah, in our just our triad discussion was I'm just wondering if you have some then formats for doing the actual the analyzing, you know, as you start to try to map out. I've worked also in international community development.
Yeah.
And we deeply appreciate it, you know, as multi-sectoral change work and logic models and theories of change were coming on board and how to do that. You know, that you start looking at all the different kinds of implications. But I'm just wondering if then, you know, I'm moving right away to the work then of the tools to do some of that mapping and the analytics that would help you to break that down a little bit.
Mm-hmm. By the way, I think one of the greatest ironies is some of the people who are best able to do this are from international development. Like, it's the irony is you're bringing it home for stuff that we need to do better here. So international development is full of adaptive pluralists, often working within regulatory neo-Newtonian paradigms. Have you ever checked out Cognitive Edge?
No.
No? Check out Cognitive Edge. They have this thing called SenseMaker. And what it is a way, you'll be familiar with it if you're working in academic circles, but it's a very powerful set of software that allows people to use narratives and to analyze narratives where the numbers can be quite huge. So when they were doing I saw a great case study of doing a thing where people were leaving a great exhibit in Tokyo and they left sharing different narratives of what they saw, and the thing in real time visualizes different perspectives on the things, queuing up keywords and meanings of and significant phrases. So there, check out Cognitive Edge as a start, but given your question, I don't mind noodling a bit about it and then passing some resources on as a follow-up to Rebecca. It really is. I will say this. When I wrote that, did that diagram of me with the horse 20 years ago, I felt on top of things. I don't feel remotely on top of things now. There's just so much stuff out there. I was telling Rebecca, I just got a book today I'm going to show you the book. I was just reading the journal this weekend, and I ordered 3 books on Sunday, and thanks to Amazon, they came just as I was leaving the door today. So this one's Invisible Women, Data Bias in a World Designed for Men, right? And it's got tons of stuff in there, and it's just, it's coming out like 2 or 3 things a week, so it's a renaissance, quite frankly.
Yeah. Yeah. So just a quick follow-up to that. Then I would say, I would be asking, I'm assuming, because of an ABCD approach of just going in and saying, then residents, citizens, can be the ones who can actually sit down to kind of walk through. So the analytics can then should be turned over to say, help us work that, you know.
Absolutely.
Whatever the issue is, going to them, right?
That's what I'm encouraged by. Have you heard of, I just spent time with the person who did ripple effect mapping with a participatory affirmative strength-based approach.
Yeah.
That is all resident-driven. Outcome harvesting, most significant change. In fact, let me leave you with this vignette on that. Has anyone used most significant change? I just love that technique. All it is you ask people who've been involved in an intervention, what's changed for you? Why is it significant? And what would your headline be if you were to do it in a newspaper article? That's the upstream. The downstream is you get everyone to, residents, participants, to talk about the most significant change story, which ones they find most significant and why, and what does it mean for the next iteration of the intervention? And here's how it started. Jess starts in Indonesia. She's doing a evaluation of a rural development program that's got a strong gender development lens to it. She's interviewing an elder from the village, and she asks her, under a very hot tree, the only place you can find shade. She says, so what has changed for you? And the translator turns around, she says, every Friday now, she didn't do this before, she walks 10 miles to a village meeting, sits there, listens, doesn't agree with much, doesn't say anything, and then goes home. So you think, well, I was hoping for more. And then she asked the next question. The evaluator, measurement's not evaluation. The evaluative question is meaning, value, judgment, that's evaluation. And she said, why is that significant? She said, in the history of this village, no woman has ever gone, been able to go to that meeting. And then she said, what's the headline for the newspaper? And she goes, next time we're all gonna say something. I got goosebumps again. And that's all participatory driven, and it generates, and if you were quant people here, there's lots of things you could go quantify, right? In the spirit of no narratives without numbers, no numbers without narratives, but both quantitative stuff is just dumbed down narratives anyways. Oops, did I say that out loud? I'm serious about that income and how well you're doing. We're trying to simplify reality by numbers, but it really is an incredibly exciting time.
Okay. Well, I think we should wrap it up. I do want to thank Mark Kabaj for joining us this evening and for all of you coming to listen. I'm always so energized, and I got lots of things, lots of thinking. I wonder how you get through your books. It's unbelievable. So I do want to thank Mark, and we have a small token of appreciation. You can put food in that bag, and it's probably a lot of food upstairs.
Going up there now.
And I also wanted to thank our Learning Advisory Committee. So we have a few members in the audience, and so they've been instrumental in helping us build out this week. And also, you know, we even brainstormed, who are we going to have to come talk? And it was top of mind, Mark Kabaj. We need somebody local. We thought, who can we bring in? Nope, he's right here, and he's our guy. I also want to thank all of our volunteers that helped us put on the event, and special shout out to both Shelley, Sinead, and, or not both, but there's three of them, and Marilyn. So making sure that everything goes according to plan, and I get to just show up, and I even have notes. People give me notes. It's so fantastic. So we will be sending out a follow-up survey, and if you want to comment on the purple, you're allowed to do that. But we really are interested in your thoughts about the event, what you'd like to learn more about, because we're looking at how we can continue to host conversations in the community around evaluation. So I invite you to come upstairs to the main foyer. We have lots of food and beverages, and if you'd like to stick around and have conversations,